session number 6016, reel 4.
Sunburnt, I didn't realise how strong the sun was. We've always been used to the cold Atlantic.
What was the accommodation like on the ship?
Not all that, really. We had to sort of put our hammock where we could. Most of the time we sort of laid it on the upper deck. It was a pretty big ship. And going through the Med's a lot easier than going through the Atlantic. A bit flatter. Or, you know, less bumpy than the thing, so it didn't matter much. Although, when we got within striking distance of Bombay within a day or two, we ran into a monsoon, and down came the rain, and of course we all had to scoop our bedding up on the quick and get back down below somewhere, scoop our hammock up, because we couldn't sort of sling it anywhere, it sort of lay on the deck, flat. But at least it was ours, whereas the army and the air force that was with us had to sort of scrounge their sleeping gear and whatever was there. I suppose the journey took about 3 weeks from Liverpool. It was a motor vessel, not a steamer. It was an old motor vessel they got.
When you arrived at Bombay, what were your first impressions of India?
Again, pretty grim, because we were there, not because we wanted to be, we were sent there. I think that's probably why. The first thing I did was change sixpence, an old sixpence, or a tanner as we used to call them, into rupees. And get to know how the money went. We put into a Royal Marines camp called Shemba. In fact, it was strange that my brother, later on in the war, he was sent there too. He was going off to Rangoon and somewhere. But it's a grim sort of place. Beetles, fleas, you name it, it's all there. Whatever disease you'd like to point out was there as well. Smallpox, cholera.
Did you fall sick whilst you were in India?
Well, I had this, what they call, when I got to Vizagapatam, wherever you go, if you're in Egypt, you get a gypo stomach, but we're in Vizag, or Vizagapatam, you get a Vizag stomach, which means diarrhoea. You go to the toilet, and before you can sort of get back to where you've been, you sort of want to go again, you've got to dash off again, and terrible pain. In fact, we had beds in this Wog Effort hut they had made, which I suppose is made of a wall of about 3 or 4 foot high, and all bamboo rushes, the rest of the walls and the roof. Sometimes it's weatherproof, depending on how strong the monsoon was when it came. I suppose it meant a walk of about 20 yards to get the toilets they rigged up there, and very often you'd never sort of make it back. You had to sort of go back again before you got back to your hut with your stomach. They cure it with stuff called something rather than belladonna and kaolin, I think it is. More like polypillet to drink. But it does a trick. In fact, one day I was in so much pain, I found myself with my feet on the pillow, my head down the other end of the bed. I was sort of so disorientated by it all.
So what type of training did you have at Vizag?
No training, we were only there. More or less to maintain these landing craft. That was all we had to do, to make sure that when they were used, that when they pulled the ramp pressed the button that worked the ramp, it worked. So it was more or less a layabout job.
So how many hours would you work a day?
Only during the morning. Too hot to work after that.
What would you do in the rest of the day?
Skive off somewhere where you keep cool. Anywhere would do. Because all we used to wear was a pair of shorts and sandals, nothing else. And as I was a leading hand, I used to wear a little thing around my wrist. This was in white with a blue anchor on it. To signify that I was a leading hand.
Did you have much to do with the local population?
No, I used to have a young boy used to hang around the camp. He said, don't want a boy to sort of do my washing for me, which I said, yes, okay. I got permission for him to come into the camp and stay. He was my bearer. He used to go and see the officer at the gate, or wherever it was, and get a permit for him to come in and out of the camp as he wished, as he liked. And for that, you pay him 10 rupees a month, which was a fortune for him. 15 shillings in actual English money. If I want anything in the village itself to go out and get it for me, he would do that. I want a mat to go alongside my bed. A rush sort of met. Only cost a few pence. I asked him to get me one day, and he got it for me.
Did the Japanese ever attempt any air raids?
Not while I was there, no.
How far were you from Vizag in this base?
We're in a place called Waltair, which is more or less in Vizag itself. And Vizag, by the look of the map, is only a few miles across the Bay of Bengal to Burma. So Japs really wasn't very far away.
Was it just you Royal Navy men there at Waltair, or were there others?
Yes, I didn't see any others, just mostly Navy.
How many of you were there?
Quite a few. I think over 1,000. We're in this sort of WOG effort camp. You seldom see everybody at once. Although I've noticed since when I've looked and read about this place, Vizagapatam is quite a big place, really, the port itself, on the Bay of Bengal, and it's quite well used.
Did you ever move about, or did you stay in Waltair the whole time?
No, more or less static there, waiting. And as soon as the Japs turned in, we were sent down to Ceylon, to a place near Colombo called Vengoda. Vengoda, which is part of a transit camp in Colombo called Maina, HMS Maina.
This was another shore base, is it?
Yes. But it's a transit camp for anybody coming home. I thought I was there for about another few months until the VJ day when it was obvious they were going to pack up.
So what were you doing at Vengoda?
Just odd jobs here and there, that's all.
Now, you were saying before that you'd gone to Ceylon, to Vengoda.
Vengoda, yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about what conditions were like living there?
Very nice. In fact, it's a beautiful place. In fact, when it's my time to come home, I wasn't particularly keen to come home. It's a beautiful place, and our accommodation was really good. It was a prefabricated huts that the Americans had sent us. And these were swept out and kept very clean by a boy. A boy probably older than I was, but he was a civilian. He's employed by the Navy. There are one or two things that happened outside of working time that might be of interest to you.
Can you tell me about them?
Yes, I was with a pal who came down with me from India, because some of the people from India, instead of coming down to Ceylon, went to Cochin in India, on the west coast of India. Whereas we went down to Ceylon, he came down with me. We'd made some homemade wine in India from coconut juice. He had a stone chatty, which he carried on his head most of the way while it was still sort of fermenting the wine. And when we got to Ceylon, it was still drinkable. And we thought, who can we trot out on? We didn't fancy drinking the ass off in case it was that potent. We didn't know. So there's a chap there named Fletcher. Tubby Fletcher's a stores rating with us. He thought we'd drink anything. We said, have one bottle of beer a week. That was mostly Canadian stuff. It's dished out every Friday.
Free, was that?
No, you used to pay 1 rupee for it, which nowadays is worth 7.5 pence. In those days, 1.6 pence, which was more or less a day's pay for some. And it's quite an occasion, beer night. And I used to, there was a lot of chaps there who were married and couldn't afford it. I used to buy their beer from them. They're very strong, but without the heat as well. And you're taught on top of that. You only need a couple of bottles and you were sort of, not paralytic, but you were sort of well away. Equivalent to a night sort of bender here. And I said to Des, that was his name, Des, my mate, my oppo rather. Who can we trot out on? He said, well, Tubby Fletcher drinks anything. So we waited until tot time, which in those days was evening time. Same old routine, tot of rum and a block of ice then, which we took out and threw away as soon as we could, and drunk the rum neat. So we said to him, fancy a lot of homemade wine, Tubby? Which he immediately said yes, eagerly. And he poured him about a quarter of a pint, I suppose, in this half-pint glass, about half-filled. After that, he's tot. And he sort of knocked it back in one go. He just had time to say how nice it was before he hit the deck. That's how strong it was. That on top of his top and the heat, of course, as well. I don't know how long he laid there. It didn't matter much to us. We proved our point that it was drinkable. And it was strong. It didn't look too bad, either. It sort of settled by that time. It was clear. It didn't look much different to water or gin, even. And he, knocked this back as quick as he could. And hit the deck. But before that, he said, how nice. He said, oh, it's nice, that. Bang. So he proved our point.
And what was the other thing you were going to tell me about?
Oh, yes, on this occasion, our bearer, I don't know what his name was, he's one of his unpronounceable names that he had, invited us out to his sort of mud hut one evening to meet his wife and children. So we went to the canteen and bought as many sweets as we could sort of justifiably take, because it was still sort of rationed stuff for us during the war. And he had a bag, he couldn't just sort of spend a couple of quid like he could nowadays. He just went in and tried to scoop in as much as you could as little as you could. And we filled our pockets up with bags of sweets and things that we thought kids would like, because kids are the same the world over. And we went with him to his mud hut. It was quite a journey. And on the way there was women doing a dough bin, which is washing. They get a flat stone and simply slam the washing after it's wet in this river or whatever or pour the water wherever they could find. Put soap on it and slam it against this flat rock and get near enough clean, or clean enough anyway. And when we got to his hut, there was his wife standing outside the hut with all his children, about half a dozen as I from memory, graduated down to the little one on the end. They welcomed us, and they was even more welcome because we were prepared to squat on the floor as they did and sort of dip our hands into the communal food pot as they did and eat with our hands. I mean, he was navy, he was young, it didn't matter much. It was lovely, whatever she cooked. It was probably goat meat, which I think is mostly used out there. And rice and all other sort of stuff that I didn't recognise, but tasted okay. We'd had our tot anyway, so it didn't matter much. Just sort of squatted round with them, gave the kids these sweets, which they're delighted with. And she was very shy. They are very shy people. Of men, wouldn't talk to us much. She sort of talked to her husband, but not to us directly. Because he could speak English that was passable enough to understand. He's very clean, too. The Ceylonese people are much cleaner than the Indians, both in appearance and in their habits.
Was that the only time you visited the house of a Ceylon person or Indian?
Oh, yes, the only time we only went there once. Because we did realise that whatever he earned at the base where he was probably his sole income. And we used to give him a couple of rupees each month. There's a dozen of us in the hut, so it'd be 24 rupees, which made him quite well off, really. Compared when you think they could probably live on 1 rupee a month.
Did anything else special happen whilst you were in Ceylon?
Now, as I say, the war was getting on towards the end now, and we had our sights on home all the time. And as my 25th birthday came up, my draft to go home was on the 24th, the day before I was due to go home. It so happened that beer night fell on my birthday too, so it's going to be a real occasion, that. Anyway, what happened was, the night before I was due to go away, I managed to get the beer brought forward one day, which was quite an achievement, because it had to come from Bombay, go through about a dozen different people's hands before they said, OK, you can do that. But a sip of my tot here and there, I worked it. And we got beer not on a Thursday instead of a Friday. Anyway, we went to tea in a normal way after we had our tot. When I came back, I was almost in tears because around my bed was all there to put their bottles of beer, giving them to me. That's quite a sacrifice too out there. So old Desi and I saw them all off. And I met a chap who lived near me in West Ham. So I happened he was a boxer in his younger days, when he was at home, not before he joined the Navy. He's a real good friend. And I drank as much of this beer as I could, plus me tot, and plus the heat. I was in Whitehall Street, I don't know what day it was even. And I was walking about all over the place. Decided I was too hot, so I'd go under the shower. So I gave me watch to somebody to mind. And when old Jimmy, that was my mate from West Ham, came to get me, I was sitting under the shower with just my shorts on and sandals, nothing else. And he said, come on. He picked me up and his shoulder was in my stomach, and by that time I was feeling a bit sick anyway. So I managed to be sick all down his back. And he carried me back to my bed, managed to get me underneath the mosquito net somehow. And the next day when I sort of came round, I didn't know what day it was 2 or 3 days before I actually got back to something like normal. He said to me, I said to him, sorry, Jim, that I was sick down your back. He says, OK, so I wiped it down with your towel up there. So I said, well, that's not mine, Jim, but thanks for doing it anyway. He'd used somebody else's towel by mistake. And I wondered about that day, trying to get my hammock lashed up. The lads helped me with it and get me gear packed in the in my kit bag. The lorry took me down to Maina, which is only about 30 miles into Colombo. I must have been walking around there for about a week before I actually knew where I was, because according to my paperwork, I'd had injections, inoculations, vaccinations, all sorts, a medical examination, which I didn't know too much about. Because everything like that is put in your paybook. Now this, I don't know what the injection was for, I'm sure, but it was all noted in there. When I got talking to somebody, they said, oh, they always do that before you go home. I was there about a day or two, and somebody called my name, and they called me Slim, because I was so skinny, which is a kind word, really. I wasn't slim, I was skinny. And then when I looked, there's a chap I knew from way back, some couple of years ago, I met him somewhere. Comes from up Birmingham way somewhere. Ron Palmer, his name was. I did keep in touch with him for a while after the war, until I lost his address. And he was waiting to come home as well. Anyway, to keep the story to the point, we used to just knock about with each other in the, with fowls inside the camp, because it was a ghastly place, Maina itself. Although we could go ashore to Colombo if we wanted to, which is a wonderful place, in my opinion. In fact, if anybody goes to Australia, all I told them is stop off at Colombo, don't get off the plane or the boat there, because you won't want to go any further. It's a beautiful place. Sunshine and beaches. Anyway, the end of it came when I was sent a note to say that I was going home on the HMS London, which is a sister ship of the one that's in the Thames of Belfast, big cruiser. She was coming home. It took us 3 weeks to get out there, and she'd done it in 15 days going back. We stopped off at Aden only. Then the port said, Aden at one end of the Red Sea, port said the other end of the Suez. And we were told while we was up the Red Sea, which was boiling point almost, Christmas time, that we'd want our winter gear out of our steaming bags ready for when we got into the Med, because the temperature there was about 10 or more degrees lower than what it was in the Red Sea. We were all laughing, taking no notice whatsoever, because it seemed unlikely that a few miles from where we were to the Med was going to be that different. We were jolly glad when we were told, anyway, because we want our winter gear on. Soon we got round into the Med. Eventually got back to home in the January of 46, which was another thing the Navy very often did if you were abroad, send you home in the middle of the winter. I think I stayed cold until about July. I couldn't stop shivering until July. My blood was that thin. I think I used to put more on to go to bed than I used to take off. And the fuel was short too, so I couldn't make a big fire up. I had no home to go to. I don't know if it's still sort of relevant. So I was sort of going to Duke's. We'd sold our home up, or packed our home up when the war started, being brothers. We all thought we were going to be called up. But as I say, I was the only one eventually. My other brother, older than I, but my youngest brother, he went in 44, he went in the army. It so happened he was across the other side of Bay of Bengal. I was the Indian side, he was the Burma side. Without knowing, he couldn't tell me where he was any more than he knew where I was, actually, although probably on a clear day with a pair of binoculars, we probably could have seen each other. Anyway, I came home and Sophie wanted my brother for a while, but obviously it wasn't going to work out for too long. He was married with a family by then. So I advertised in the local paper for digs, and I had about six or seven replies. I went down to see all of them. And the one I picked, I'm afraid I backed the loser. I picked the wrong one. Didn't work out very well at all with them. They didn't want me particularly. They wanted me pay, they wanted me money. You know, they wanted me, all they were interested in making a few of out of me. I wasn't treated particularly well.
So, you were in the Navy for about 5 years altogether.
Just about, yeah. Close on to 5 years. Near to 5 years, it makes no difference.
How would you summarise your period in the Navy?
Well, I think I was very fortunate, really, because at the time, if you note the times I was in it, I could have been on mortar convoys, I could have been on Russian convoys, but it wasn't. I could have gone across to D-Day, but didn't. I was probably as far away from D-Day as possible and still be in Britain. So I think I was lucky, really. I came away without a physical scratch. What it did to me mentally, I don't know, or anybody else. Nobody will ever know. In fact, nobody will ever know how it sort of contributed to this lot.
To your stroke?
Yeah, eventually.
Do you think it might have?
Well, I don't, but somebody else does, so I mentioned it too. Because when I was in hospital, the time that I was in there, most of us were the same sort of age. We were all in our 50s, about 56 or 7. We were all a young batch, as we were described as a young batch anyway. And when I spoke to somebody whose opinions I do respect, she said, oh, yeah, he's probably all in the war. That's why you all got it at the same time. But whether that is so or not, I don't know.
Do you think that the fact that you missed these dangerous things like Russian convoys and Malta convoys and so on was just sheer luck, or because you'd been classified as B2?
No, I could have been on either of them. I could have been. They didn't sort of discriminate once you... I think the reason I went to Pyramus, instead of going... when I was in Barracks for quite some time, I was due to go on to Beverley. I think probably according to their records, I did actually go to Beverley and was a survivor, possibly. I don't know. That's the way things work. They're all cockeyed in the Navy anyway, most of the time.
By cockeyed, you mean disorganised?
Yes.
Did you, at any stage of the war, think that Britain might lose?
No, never at any time. In fact, when I was first called up, it was all sort of choked because we'd been called up and away from home. This was far back at Hayling Island when we were doing our initial training. We were in a canteen one day at Standeasy, which was 10 minutes in the morning and 10 minutes in the afternoon. They would pipe Standeasy. You would go in there and have a cup of tea or whatever. You could have a smoke too, officially, although most of us used to smoke unofficially wherever we could. And when the Standeasy was finished, the pipe would be out pipes, hands carry on with your work. And during that period at Hayling Island, it was pouring the rain, miserable day, everybody was up to here, up to their chin in misery. And I remember singing a song of the day called I've Got Sixpence, Jolly Jolly Sixpence. Do you remember that one yourself?
Yeah.
Yeah, if I don't, other people would have that age, I'm sure. I thought, well, I don't know, the Germans don't stand a chance here, and we just don't stand a chance. But us feeling as we do, and we can sing like this, they're never going to beat us, that's for sure. Never at any time did I think that we were ever going to be on the losing side, if it can be described as a losing side. There's never winners, only losers, in war, in my opinion. Some people do make a packet out of wars. I don't know anybody, but I do know people... back market and people that are left at home. I had some chap telling me, long after the war had finished, how he used to spend during the war. He was able to sort of buy more or less what he wanted on the black market. He was in the furniture trade, and all his wood came via the black market, pay a bit more for it. He'd sell his furniture at fabulous prices. Make a good thing out of the war.
Was that type of thing resented by other people?
Well, it was by us who came home after and found out what was going on.
Did you know about it at the time?
Not during the war, no. I think everybody was sort of patriotic, the same as we were.
That's all I can think of to ask you about your war service.
Mm-hmm.
But if there's anything else that you can think of to add, we can add it now.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what might be of interest, that on one of the trips we did, as I say, we used to go out every day almost somewhere. We had to go dashing out into the Atlantic, three destroyers again, and we weren't told what for, but we were told to sort of keep alert. And I was off watch at the time, and the alarm bells rang, and the buzzers went, which meant sea action and air action. In other words, get there quick. And when I got up on deck, I saw in the distance three smaller ships and one big one. Now, at that time, the Scharnhorst was about, or you know, one of the bigger ones, or the Bismarck even. I thought, oh, Christ, I hope it's not that. But it so happened it was three destroyers bringing the Rodney, HMS Rodney, a battleship from the States. She'd been knocked about and she'd been repaired in the States. Brought her so far in the Atlantic, going to take her from there up to Reykjavik again, our usual rendezvous. And they showed her appreciation. When we got to Reykjavik, they invited us aboard and gave us a cinema show. But of course, being on a battleship as she was, everything was immense compared to what we'd been used to. Their recreation space was bigger than our living space. And where they showed the film even was much bigger than where we had to live in. That was 20-odd men. And we hadn't got our own transport to go to the Rodney, so the Yanks lent us one of their ducks, as they called them. We all sort of scrambled aboard that and got over there. They treated us really well. It was sort of courteous of them.
So, in the Navy, was a posting on a big ship like a battleship a plum posting?
Well, not really, but when you read or heard of the Hood, I mean, she went up in her first engagement, didn't she? She was sunk. So not really safe. But the trouble is, with a big ship, you get a lot more routine. It's more what they call passer. And passer is a sort of slang name for purser. It used to be in the old days. Anything that is passer is Navy. If you had a Navy-issued suit on, you had a passer suit on. But invariably, most of us used to have them made the measure, so they fitted at least. In places, if not all over. But on a battleship or a big ship, anything above a destroyer, is a lot more routine. Whereas on a destroyer, all we used to wear was our hat, cap, and a pair of overalls. And sea boots, of course. Not as a uniform, except your cap. You had to have some part of your uniform on in case you were sunk and were picked up.
So you mean on a small ship like a destroyer, it was less formal?
Hmm. Just as alert, but less formal. If you saw a skipper, you might sort of give him a salute, and you may not. But he wouldn't pounce on you if you didn't. And he used to have divisions, which are a Sunday thing, like church service, which you were made to attend on a big ship or a shore establishment, whether you wanted to or not, long as it was your denomination, either Church of England or Roman Catholic, whatever you were. If it was on, you had to go. And I resented that a great deal. It turned me off religion for a long, long time. I didn't like the idea of being told that I must go and... But what did impress me was when we was at sea, or if we came into harbour anywhere, the chaplain used to come off with Captain D. There was always a Captain D, Captain Destroyer, which was invariably the flotilla leader. In our case, the Inglefield, HMS Inglefield, again with the I. The only ship I know, the two ships that I know that were sunk of the eye of our particular flotilla was the Imogen, which was cut in two by a troop ship in the Med, and the Imperial, which was sunk off Crete earlier on, before I joined the Navy.
So, on the destroyers, you mean religious services were optional?
Well, no, you had to go, or you expected to go, you wanted to go, I did anyway, because it was so sort of simple, the service. The chaplain used to bring a Union Jack or the White Ensign with him, and hang it over the capstan on the forecastle. All you did was sort of stand around in whatever rig you were in, as long as you were tidy and clean yourself. If you weren't growing a beard, you expected to shave and be washed, cleaned. It just used to give us a, you know, short service, the sort of words coming as they came rather than out of the book. And invariably a good older chap, an older man than most officers, usually had grey hair. And I used to be impressed by the service he used to give. Quite good. Talking about the men who go down to the sea in ships, you know, that type of thing.